Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We are going to turn the page and now consider Yahweh's testimony. Scott, during the break, was just talking to me and saying, you know, it's only a matter of time between now and the issuance of a decree that Yahweh's Torah is in conflict with political correctness, with the hate speech edicts that are going to be imposed upon Americans. And it's, you know, call for heterosexual unions is going to be called into question. Excuse me. And it's just a matter of time before Yahweh's direct opposition to religion and politics is going to be become listed amongst the enemies of the American government. And just as it was with Constantine, you know, if you observe anything that Yahweh had asked of us, according to General Constantine, who became the first pope and the creator of the Roman Catholic Church, the punishment for doing anything that God said was death.
Yeah, and it's because of exactly like you said. It tells you to walk away from religion and government, and
right.
Which government is slowly becoming people's religion.
Correct. It is. They're becoming totally dependent upon their government. Their politics has become their religion, and their reliance is upon government. And as you realize, it's anything that precludes people from surrendering their liberty and their minds to government will be considered the enemy. That's what is being targeted as extremism. That's why the President of the United States wants this to be a war against extremism as opposed to Islamic terrorism. And there is no one who is more extreme in his position than God himself.
Yeah, and I mean, the Torah, it doesn't ever tell you, you know, he tells you to use your mind, think for mm-hmm. yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then he gives you all these things that, you know,
make a choice.
You could do these things, you know, you can,
yeah.
you don't have to, you don't have
But he's going to tell you, you know, you should. This is something I'm going to, like, for example, as it relates to the Shabbat, he says, here's my fatherly advice. This is something you should do. Does he say you must do this? No. Does he say you have to obey this rule? No.
No, but he says if you want, you know, I want to get to know you. If you want, you got to try and get to know me, though. And these are some
yes.
of the things that I want you to do, you know.
Right. And if you want to have a relationship with me. If you don't want to have a relationship with me, you can do whatever you want.
You
just know that there's a consequence of that.
You make your own choice. You
right.
You still get to live your life. You still get to do whatever you want to do. And at the end, if you were
yep.
really dumb, you have to pay for what you decided to do. But if
yeah, that's right. It's up to a point, and that's why the government will ultimately come down on anyone who adheres to and respects Yahweh's Torah teaching, which is there is a point. If you're the victim of politics and religion, no harm, no foul. You lived your life. You were misled. You never knew God, and therefore at the end of your life is just the end of your existence. But if you're like Dianne Feinstein and deliberately, purposefully aiding and abetting that which is destructive and lying about it and deceiving the American people, there's a consequence for that. And the consequence for that is that she will be judged in accordance with the statement that we read yesterday and the day before. Relative to her behavior and leading people away from Yahweh, she falls under the group of people that is in that list to be judged, and the consequence is going to be separation, estrangement, and incarceration. So, you know, to a degree, those who want you to be dependent on them, want you to believe them in government, for example, are indeed God's enemies. And God will hold them accountable. So the last thing that Constantine wanted, for example, was for someone to listen to God. Because if they listened to God, they wouldn't listen to him. And the same thing is true with the American government and European governments, which is why they will ultimately do the same thing that Constantine did. Now, they don't have to at the moment. You see, they don't have to at the moment. Because of the fact most Americans have been successfully beguiled by their religion and by politics and by patriotism so that they do not know that they're ignoring God. It wouldn't even dawn on them. You know, if you tell the Patricks of the world that God's name is Yahweh and that his Torah still stands and that Yahusha did not annul it and there is no New Testament, there is no Gospels, you know, it's like, what in the world are you saying? It's like they've never even conceived of the possibility that a God named Yahweh exists and that he shared everything we need to know with us. Just they're oblivious to it. So there's no reason to preclude people from reading and observing Yahweh's Torah at a time when 99.999% of the people aren't even interested in it. But when things get worse, which they're going to, and it becomes obvious that the only reliable voice is Yahweh's, people are going to turn to it. And when they do, the Torah will be turned into the enemy of government, just as it was when Constantine turned his military might as a general into religious might as the first pope of the Roman Catholic Church. So, Scott, your point is valid. Let's return to where we were in talking about the Shabbat. God said, you should observe, which means you should be aware of. You should pay attention to. You should closely examine and carefully consider. The seventh day, the Shabbat, means seventh day. It means promise. That it is set apart, recognizing that it is special, that it is separated for a particular reason. Now, there's two ways to look at separated, set apart. One of them is, as we talked in a program either one or 2 days ago, which is the idea that to be set apart, you come to understand who Yahusha is, who the set apart spirit is. The set apart spirit is set apart from Yahweh. Yahusha is Kodesh Kodesh, or the most set apart, because he's not only set apart, a part of Yahweh set apart from him, but also some of his Yah's spiritual energy becomes physical presence, set apart twice. And that kind of set apart helps you understand who God is and how God works in our lives, how God went about enabling his promises, which is the whole concept of the Shabbat, is the promise associated with seven. The promise of seven is there are 6 days representing man, who was created on the sixth day, and primarily out of carbon, which has a molecular weight of six days, so that we, in addition to God, who is one, six plus one equals God's desired result of man and God coming together and being much greater synergistically than we are independently. That's God's idea of perfection. That's God's idea of the ultimate formula that makes the universe worth creating, life worth conceiving, the covenant worth making, the invitations worth facilitating. And so it is set apart. God set part of himself apart to facilitate this, to enable it, to make these promises so that they can be materialized in our own lives. And so the first thing he tells us about the promise of seven is that the day is special, that it is set apart. That means that it shares, the Shabbat and Yahusha share something in common. The Shabbat and the set apart spirit share something in common. Because their work for us is done while we rest. They do the work. And that means that to associate Sunday with Yahusha and with the set apart spirit is an abomination. Putrid, disgusting. The equivalent of walking in bull poo, to quote God. And he next says, after set apart, and by the way, as I said, there's two aspects of set apart. One we've just discussed. The other is the part that we've been discussing during the first hour. To be set apart unto Yahweh, to set the Shabbat apart unto Yahweh, it must be set apart from the common and mundane. This day is to be set apart from the corruption of religion and politics and military schemes and intelligence schemes. It's to be set apart from our ordinary work lives. Just as we, individually, our souls, are set apart from the world of corrupt world of humankind, the world of decaying physical entities, to God, to his covenant family. So you can be set apart from the world of Babylon unto the covenant, just as Yahweh sets apart aspects of his nature to facilitate the covenant. Set apart works both ways. When God says, I want you to be observant, that's what he's talking about. Make those connections. Notice them, consider them, understand them. So you should observe the Shabbat, the seventh day, which is set apart, as Yahweh, your God, instructed. Yahweh is God's name. It's his only name. He reveals it 7,000 times. Yod Heh Wah Heh. The Yod was written as a upper arm reaching down, a forearm reaching out, and an open hand. That is how God is identifying himself to us. Reaching down and out to us with an open hand. Just like a father would to their child. This next three letters, two of them are repeated. You have two people standing up. I think the two people represent the covenant with Abraham and Sarah. Sarah being the basis of Yisrael, meaning individuals who engage and endure with God. Sarah means to engage and to endure. Yisrael means individuals who, ish, individuals, Sarah, who engage and endure, El, with God. And Abraham represents Yehudim, the direct descendants of he and through Jacob and Ishmael, excuse me, not Ishmael, excuse me, through Yishak, which is, means laughter, which is the purpose of the covenant, to laugh, to have a good time. And then Jacob, whose name means one who walks in a steadfast way, is to really dig in your heels so that you're not wavering from one place to another. You can't be pulled aside from the path. You know, you're steadfast in your commitment to walk to God along the path that he has provided, who became Yisrael. That the two individuals that represent the two Hays in Yahweh's name, I see as the first participants in the covenant, as Sarah and Abraham, held together by that security of the tent peg, enlarging their security and family. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering Yahweh's testimony in Devarim, which means words, corrupted to Deuteronomy, which means second, and nomos is kind of an interesting word. It's often translated law in Bibles. It does not mean law. It's really an allotment. It's specifically an allotment or nourishment that aids and abets an inheritance. It's the word nomos is the word that every time you read Torah, the many hundreds of times the Torah is written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. In the Septuagint, when the Greek text was used to translate the Hebrew in the Torah, virtually all 200 some odd times that Torah was written, it was replaced by a variation of nomos. And Deuteronomy is a combination of two, deut and nomos, being considered second law, therefore, when in fact the word in Torah in Hebrew means teaching, guidance, direction, instruction, and the word nomos, its root was nourishment or an allotment which benefits an inheritance. And so you see how migration over time and religious proclivities have a tendency to warp and twist what God conveyed. But anyway, the name of the book, according to God, is Devarim. To continue what God said, and while I'm citing from what's called Devarim 5:12, understand that the Torah was not divided into chapters and verses. God's testimony is never divided into chapter and verses. So when somebody takes an isolated verse as we consider them now out of context, that was would be considered egregious by God. So he says, you should observe, which means to closely examine and carefully consider, everything associated with the Shabbat, the seventh day, the day of promise. A day which is set apart, Kodesh. And we've discovered all of the insights, the many wonderful insights, both about making the Shabbat and the promise special from Kodesh, recognizing that the Shabbat being Kodesh, therefore, shares an affinity with Yahusha, who is the Kodesh Kodesh, most set apart, and the Kodesh, the Ruach Kodesh, which is the set apart spirit. And that it also shares this understanding with God is asking us, inviting us to be set apart from the world of Babylon, of corruption, of politics and religion, and set apart unto him, just as he sets apart certain aspects of himself to facilitate his covenant promises with us. It's then as Yahweh, your God, instructed. We were talking about Yahweh's name, the characters that comprise it so that we understand it. Now, I said your God. It is written most often in Hebrew as a God is typically written as a derivative of Eloah. And the Eloah derivatives that is used the most is Elohim. And Elohim would be the plural of this contracted form of El. And there's, and I receive probably once a month a really nasty letter from somebody that says, you know, you are a disgusting individual because you use the pagan name God. And here I have translated Elohim as God. And that bears just a bit of understanding if we can do that. God actually isn't the name of a pagan god. It is a derivation. We're told if you look at the etymology, the closest thing to it in terms of the English sound and to create the English word would be Got. And Got wasn't so much the name of the Teutonic god as it was the Teutonic god's title. In other words, it was used the same way we use the word God to be a title of deities. Yahweh uses Elohim, the very term that is used here, in the context of false Elohim. So, you know, God's when God himself uses his word to describe false gods, saying that, you know, I am the only true El God, and there are false Elohim gods, then since he uses Elohim to convey true and false, then the fact that there are true and false gods and that it is a title being used in this way seems absolutely appropriate. And the whole notion of we're speaking in English, this is a title, I can transliterate the title, but then I'm not communicating, or I can translate the title into the closest English comparison, which is God. We'll return to Shattering This in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering This. I am your host, Yada. The reason that I have stopped in the midst of this construction, you should observe the Shabbat, the day, the seventh day, the day of promise, because it is set apart as Yahweh, your God, instructed, is because second only to letters that say that I have lied about Islam by quoting Muhammad and Allah, which seems kind of odd to me. How can you distort the meaning of Islam by quoting Muhammad and his wannabe God Allah? But second to that, I probably get more hateful letters, just mean-spirited letters, directed at me for the use of God in addition to Yahweh's name. And so this is something that really irritates folks. And so I'm not going to tell you that I'm right, because I don't like to do that, because I'm a flawed individual. I can make mistakes. I'm just going to tell you my thought process for using God as opposed to using El, Elohim, or Mighty One. Okay? So, first of all, I have shared with you that that the basis of it is from Eloah. And El and Elohim, the singular and the plural, are derivations of the Hebrew word Eloah. The first thing I shared with you is that God himself, Yahweh himself, used El and Elohim to not only describe his title, not his name. You know, at the moment that you go from God to name, you're inconsistent with Yahweh's testimony. Yahweh has but one name. It is Yahweh. That is his only name. It's the only way he wants to be called. It's the only way he wants to be remembered. He has but one name, and he's told us that the only name that he wants us to use in reference to him is Yahweh. That is his name. It's his one and only name. You go to any site, and you type in God, and it will tell you that God is a name. It is not a name. It is a title. Now, just because lots of people deceive and have a common statement, it's like Allahu Akbar, and they'll say it means God is great. It doesn't mean that. And just because 1,000 sites say that that's what it means does not change the fact it's not what it means. And that Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater or most great, or Allah is the greatest. Well, the same thing is true with El and Elohim from Eloah. It's not a name for Yahweh. Yahweh is his one and only name. Now, Yahweh himself uses El and Elohim, this title, to describe himself and to describe false gods. Just as the English word God can be used to describe the real God, his title, or false gods. In fact, in English, we have an advantage that does not exist in Hebrew, which is capitalization. You can use a lowercase g for the false gods, and you can use the capital G for the title of the real God, Yahweh. Now, most people that write me in this regard say that I should either transliterate El or Elohim, but if I do that, I've got an issue. One is that it's a word. Titles are words. It's not a name. You translate words, and you transliterate names. To transliterate means you convey the sound of the name in the language that you're speaking. In other words, Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, is always Yahweh. That's how it's pronounced no matter what language you're using. But with a word, you translate the meaning of the word. Okay, what does El Elohim from Eloah mean? What is the closest English equivalent to that word? It's the word God. That's how it was perceived by the children of Israel who first heard these words. Oh, yeah, Yahweh, he's our God. Capital G, in our case, in English. All right, so one of the reasons that I don't is because titles, being common words, should be translated as opposed to transliterated. Second is, guess what the name was of the principal Canaanite god? The you know, when Yahweh told the children of Israel that the iniquity, the sin, the depravity, the corruption, the perversion of those living in Canaan was complete, that there was no hope for them. What do you think that the name was of the principal Canaanite god? El. El was his name. So if I use El, I'm actually using, if I use it as a name, then I'm using the name of not just a pagan god, but an extraordinarily irritating pagan god from God's perspective, from Yahweh's perspective. By the way, El was the father of Baal in the Canaanite religion. So El, the name of the chief Canaanite god, fathered the Lord. Baal means Lord. It's a counterfeit of Yahweh fathering Yahusha. That's how religious corruptions work. That's how Satan operates. So, since El does mean mighty, it conveys the idea of might. It's a combination of the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, which is drawn in the form of a ram's head. It not only conveys the leadership and the power of the ram to protect the flock, but it also conveys the notion of the ram's horn, which is the teruah. It is the this whole concept of the shofar or trumpet that that God uses to call his our attention to him, and it represents the Passover lamb, which Yahweh became for the purpose of saving us, providing the doorway to eternal life and the doorway to his home. That's all conveyed by the ram's head with the L. It, the other letter, at least in the contracted form and in the singular, is Lamed. Lamed is a shepherd's staff. So with God's name El, not name, I'm sorry, God's title El, what you find is that it's a combination of the Passover lamb, the Passover ram in this particular case, because it's a male lamb, and the shepherd's staff. So you're getting Yahweh presenting himself as the one with the power and authority to lead us, to shepherd us, to personally engage by becoming the Passover lamb and acting as our shepherd, which means protecting us, nurturing us, guiding us as a shepherd with the shepherd staff with the lamed. Powerful visual concepts that convey the fullness of this title that Yahweh has chosen. But if I translate it as mighty, then it would be as Yahweh, your mighty instructed. Or I can keep it plural, as it's usually written in the plural form throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, as the day Yahweh, your mighties, instructed. Or because it really is a ram's head and a staff, that Yahweh, your ram's head and shepherd's staff, instructed. Or if I just translate it, as most would say, as mighty one, well, guess what the name was, if we were to translate it into English, of the Canaanite God? Mighty one. Now, it's also interesting, as I shared just briefly with you, that while Gat is the is what we're told is kind of the basis of the, and it's really a loose basis of the word in English that we use as God. Gat was also used as a title. That the Teutonic God was named after the sun, and they used Helios and other words related to the sun as their primary deity. So it's been a title even back in the day. Now, all of this known, the choice that I have made is to translate El and Elohim as God, capital G, when it's being applied to Yahweh, lowercase g, when it's being applied to false gods. And I use it as an English word, as a title and not as a name, and to convey the same meaning that I think that the children of Israel would have ascribed to it and that God is ascribing to it, Yahweh is ascribing to it. Now, does that mean that I am right and that this is the only viable choice and that those who are lashing out at me, criticizing me for doing this, are wrong? No. No. But what I'd like to do as part of this program is to give you the basis of the information required and the thought process so that you can make your own determination. You know, I'm not telling you that I'm right and that they're wrong. What I'm telling you is this is how I went about it. This is the evidence that I collected and the connections that I made to make the choice to do this. And I'm not telling you that sometime along the way that I might, you know, say, you know, boy, I've collected more information and made another connection somehow that's led to the conclusion that I'm going to say Yahweh, your Elohim in the future. Maybe I'll do that. You know, at this point, that's not where I'm at. And I feel comfortable with this. And now you know the reasons behind it and you can make up your own mind. The only thing I would ask is that if you disagree, is tell the whole truth when you disagree. You know, actually explain what the issues associated with even trying to define the derivation of God in English The fact that it was used as a title, not typically as a name, the fact that, every time it's referred to as a name in a scholarly tome or in a lexicon or dictionary, that use is almost always wrong. I mean, explain the whole truth. Don't just cite parts of the truth. And don't forget the fact that El was the name of the principal Canaanite deity whose son was Baal, the Lord. So let's tell the whole truth. Let's not, and there's no reason to be vicious in one's reply here. Okay, so you should observe, that means examine, that means consider, the Shabbat, the seventh day, the day of promise, set apart, special, separating it for the purpose of purification, as Yahweh, your God, your Elohim, if you prefer, instructed. The last word is so essential. It is from Sawa. Sawa is specifically designed to convey the ideas of guidance and direction. So it's teaching, guidance, direction, instruction. Now there are a number of Hebrew words that convey teaching, guidance, direction, instruction. The primary of them is Torah. But so does Shavuot. And so what God is saying here, if you're going to observe the Shabbat, you observe the Shabbat by looking where? Where would you closely examine? What would you carefully consider based upon as Yahweh your God instructed? Does he have a book of instructions? And is it not called the Torah? Maybe that's what he's asking us to do here. Read the Torah on the Shabbat. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering Yahweh's instructions regarding the seventh day. He told us where we should closely examine and carefully consider, which was his instructions, his sawa, his teaching, his guidance, his directions, which is his Torah. That is what he's telling us. He says, you should. It's in your interest to be aware of, to closely examine, to carefully consider this is God speaking, Yahweh, my instructions, my teaching, which is his Torah, on the subject of the Shabbat, the seventh day, the promise, which is the Yahweh's plan of salvation. It's God's purpose for creating the universe, all embodied in the concept of 6 + 1 = 7. Tells you the God's timeline for salvation. It tells you when he's been here and when he's going to return. It tells you the path that he's following relative to our salvation. And it tells you what God's intended result is. All of that is available to us when we observe, when we shamar the Shabbat. All of it. Particularly when we observe the Shabbat in light of it being set apart and in light of it being part of Yahweh's instruction. Now, that's a lot of things. It describes, when you do this, you have available to you the express purpose for God creating the universe and authoring life. It is Shabbat. Because man, created of carbon with a molecular weight of 6, created on the sixth day. Molecular weight of 6 means it has 6 electrons and 6 protons. That man created on the sixth day, in addition to God, with God, plus God, who is 1, 6 + 1 = 7. That's the formula. That's the purpose. That's God's reason for creating the universe, for authoring life, and for offering the covenant. Now that's a powerful thing that you can learn by observing and considering Shabbat. It tells you the timeline that God is going to work to accomplish his desired result is 6 + 1 = 7. Well, it was in way back now almost 6,000 years ago that 3968 BCE. That Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden. God had 6 + 1 = 7 in the Garden of Great Joy of Eden. But nearly 6,000 years ago, 20 years shy of 6,000 years ago now, that promise was severed. That opportunity was severed. when Adam and Chawa were expelled from the Garden of Eden. And that began the time clock on the 6,000 years plus 1,000 years. That's the timeline. And so what we find is that 1,000 years from 3968 BCE was the flood, occurred right on schedule. Again, all about separating those who had chosen to be with God from those who had chosen to reject God. 1,000 years thereafter, 40 yobel from the time that the covenant was severed with Abraham and Chawa because they were compelled to leave the garden because they chose to reject God and his instruction. They didn't pay attention to God and his instruction. 40 yobel thereafter, 1968 BCE, Abraham and Yahweh, in conjunction with Sarah, formalize the covenant, establishing the covenant on Mount Moriah, with God providing that very lamb that embodies the first letter in his title. And with a shepherd, which is what Abraham became, holding that shepherd's staff right there at the same time, embodying the purpose of his name. Even Abraham as his name means merciful, enriching father. All right there before our eyes. 40 yobel, 2,000 years after the covenant was separated, the covenant is reaffirmed, reestablished as an opportunity for all of us. 1968 BCE. 1,000 years later, 968 BCE, what happened? On that exact same mountain, in that exact same place, Dode collects everything associated, that's David, everything associated with building the first house for Yahweh on earth, the temple. And Solomon actually gets to construct it. 968 BCE, the cornerstone for Yahweh's home, the temple, is laid. What happened 1,000 years after that, which would be another 40 yobel from the time that the covenant was conceived in the fourth millennia of human history? The greater light became visible to us as a sign to fulfill the Moed. And we witnessed Yahusha fulfill Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua, the promise of seven sevens, all to facilitate the covenant. Are you noticing a promise being made and delivered before your eyes?